Blog Talk Radio.
Is your business protected against the threat of malicious litigation and frivolous lawsuits? Are you sinking company profits into marketing campaigns that do nothing to contribute to the growth of your business? Bottled Business Sense provides practical business perspectives that uniquely emphasize both legal and media marketing strategies to protect and ensure the longevity of your business. And whether you're trying to provide a startup business with some level of stability, or an established business with foolproof asset and estate protection, or simply attempting to get a better return for your business marketing dollars, Bill Bernard and Rick Muscoso will expose potential pitfalls to ensure the security and growth of your business, free from unwanted expense and the threat of litigation. You'll learn how to implement marketing and protection tools equal to those used by today's most successful corporations. Let's join Bill and Rick for today's Bottled Business Sense Show.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone. We are here back on the Bottled Business Sense Show. It's Tuesday morning here at 10 a.m. Thank you for being with us today. We have an incredible show in regards to legal aspects of estate planning, and that is titled Your Rights as a Beneficiary in Estate Planning. But before we get on to the show, I wanted to introduce my co-host, Bill Bernard, on the other side. How are you doing today, Bill?
I'm doing great, Rick. Thanks. And hi, everybody. Glad to have you back with us for another show. Bottled Business Sense Show is, of course, is geared towards small business owners and people interested in protecting their estate and their business and moving forward and getting great marketing tips from guys like Rick who can help your business prosper. So we're here every week to try to do that, to keep that ship rolling along and protect it at the same time, that ship being your business, of course. And I hope we can provide some information today, Rick, which I get a lot of questions about all the time, and that is, you know, I'm a beneficiary. My dad or mom has a will, or I have a trust, and it's a different, might be a different kind of trust. What am I entitled to as a beneficiary? What exactly is the score here? So I thought we would approach it in two ways, maybe talk about vesting rights very briefly and then talk about what you might be entitled to as a beneficiary. That is to say, when do your rights come into play, and when they do, what are they?
Awesome. Well, before we get started, Bill, you know, folks, if you do have questions during the show or have some ideas for future shows or even need to speak with Bill, we'll give you that contact information later on in the show. But in the meantime, you're always welcome to give us feedback via email at bottledbusinesssenseshow@gmail.com. We're all over social media as well. So we look forward to your comments, your suggestions, your feedback. And if you want to be a guest on the show as well, we welcome that, and we'd welcome you to be to go ahead and email us. We have a form for you to fill out in regards to the topics that you may talk about. So with that being said, you know how to get a hold of us. Now let's get into the show. Bill is going to talk about your rights as a beneficiary in estate planning.
Yeah, let's talk about a few preliminary matters first, Rick. You know, remember, we can talk about, and we've discussed a number of these issues in past shows, of course. We can talk about a will, and of course, I always say you need a trust package, which includes a pour-over will, rather than just a will by itself. If you have a will by itself, or if you have no will, you're going to probate court, and there comes the cost and the fees and the length of time and the public documentation of the estate. So a will just tells the court who you want to get your stuff, but you still got to go through probate. No will tells the court to decide who gets your stuff by what's called intestate succession, your heirs by law. So a will by itself, or no will, in a word, stinks. Okay? You got to have a pour-over will, and that's a little bit different. We've talked about that in another show, and that goes with a living trust package. You got to have a trust. So your vesting rights as a beneficiary in an estate plan depend upon whether you just have a will by itself, whether you're the beneficiary of a person who only has a will by itself, whether you're the beneficiary of someone who has a revocable living trust, one that can be revoked and changed at any time, or one that is the beneficiary of an irrevocable trust, where the settlor or the trustor, the creator of the trust, cannot revoke it. So let's briefly talk about a will first by itself. Your rights in whatever you're getting by way of the will vest upon at the time the decedent passes away. So whoever creates the will, you get you have really no rights to anything other than what you're going to get at the time the decedent dies. Now, when the decedent dies, your rights then automatically vest. If you have a irrevocable trust, one that can't be revoked, your rights vest at the time the trust is funded. So remember, you got to make a trust, and then you got to fund it. The trust means nothing unless you put your assets into the trust. Now, an irrevocable trust will give you protection from probate, and it will give you asset protection, right? So, but let's leave that alone for the purposes of this show. I'm just pointing out an irrevocable trust will give you both. So an irrevocable trust, the assets in the trust now belong to the trustee of the trust or the trust itself. They no longer belong to you. So if you're a beneficiary of that trust created by the trustor or the settlor, your rights vest at the time the trust is funded. So, Rick, you have a piece of property and you want to put it in this irrevocable trust. Okay, you're going to have to go down to the county recorder's office and have it put into the name of the trust and recorded and notarized in order to fund the trust with that property. Because if you have a trust and you leave it in your name and don't put it in the name of the trust, well, then it's worthless. It's a worthless trust because it's not funded. So if you have an irrevocable trust, one that cannot be changed by the settlor or the trustor, and that's an interchangeable name, the creator of the trust. If you have an irrevocable trust and you're the beneficiary of that trust, your trust, your rights vest at the time that trust is funded. Now let's go to the third category, the revocable trust, one you can revoke or change at any time, and this is the one that most people have. Your rights will vest again upon the death of the creator of the trust. Again, the trustor or the settlor. However, you have some very important rights nevertheless. Okay? Again, to distinguish, Rick, for our listeners and viewers, the only thing that a will by itself and that a revocable trust, one you can revoke at any time, have in common is that the rights vest upon the passing of the creator of that document, whether it be the will or the trust. Now, it's been asked a lot, I'm a beneficiary, and I know, Bill, my rights don't vest until the death of the trustor, because he had a revocable living trust. But, exactly what are those rights? And what am I entitled to, if anything, besides waiting for this guy or this gal to pass away? Am I entitled to anything? And, if you're creating an estate plan and you're going to name some beneficiaries, you would think you would want them to know what their rights are, right, Rick?
Absolutely.
You would hope. But, that's why you appoint a trustee to run the estate for you. Many times the creator of the trust is also the trustee. If he might have a successor trustee and a second successor trustee named in case he becomes incapacitated or has some health issues.
So give us an example of who typically that would be.
Well, it would be anybody that you trust. After all, that's where the name trust came from in Roman times. You're going to pick a trustee based on the level of trust you have for that person. So it doesn't matter. It could be a brother, a sister, an aunt, an uncle, a cousin. It could be a friend. It could even be an institution, like a life insurance company, a banking institution. It could be any number of entities or individuals, depending on the level of trust and objectivity you feel that trustee can provide when running this this estate plan on your behalf.
So couldn't it also be an attorney like you if you were doing my trust? Could it be someone like you?
To answer your question from a technical standpoint, yes, it could be. An attorney could be a trustee, but it's not often recommended because there could be some friction with the beneficiaries if the beneficiaries think you're taking advantage of the situation. Okay, and there's a number of ways that might happen. Oftentimes, you want to remain completely objective and in the shadows. Now, there is what's called a trust protector, meaning that an attorney, presumably the attorney who created the trust, can be the trust protector. So in case the beneficiary needs help in some way, that trust protector will have appointed powers that are designated inside the trust where he can come in and step in and do certain things on behalf of the trustee. Remember now, sometimes the trustee is also the creator of the trust, as we said.
Okay. Is that an extra provision that you would write in? Or,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to have that in there. And you can determine as the creator of the trust whether that trust protector is going to be compensated or not, just like the creator of the trust can decide whether or not the trustee is going to be compensated. It's not a requirement, but it has to be set forth in the trust so the compensation provision is provided for, or at the very least it says that the trustee and or the trust protector will serve without compensation. You see that oftentimes as well. So let's talk a little bit about exactly what you might be entitled to as a beneficiary of a revocable living trust while the creator of the trust is still alive. And, you know, we want to make sure that we keep the people in the loop. I've never understood a trustee who wants to remain very secretive. Sometimes you'll have family friction, Rick, and you'll say, well, you know, this and that, and this person might get upset at this and that. Well, you know, you have to take that into account when you form the trust, who you're going to leave what to, and you ought to do that with an open mind, realizing that at the forefront, you're going to want to make these people aware of exactly what they're going to get. It's not like the old days where you see the Perry Mason movie, you know, and some guy's reading a trust at the end. Oh, this guy's been left $1 million, and he's jumping up and down and screaming and yelling and hollering, and his brother gets the stamp collection, you know? No, you don't do it that way. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the first, before we take our first break, let's talk about the first right that I feel you're entitled to as a trust beneficiary. And that would be the right to be informed of the existence of a trust. You have the right to be informed of the existence of a trust to which you are a beneficiary, okay? So don't let somebody tell you that, well, I'm a beneficiary of a trust, and or I may be a beneficiary of a trust, but I don't know. You have a right to know if you're a beneficiary because the trustee has a duty to advise you if you're a beneficiary. Okay?
Okay.
So that's important. Notification. Notice is always very, very important. And likewise, the right to be informed of the property that composes the trust is required, and you have a right to inspect the trust instrument, but only when it becomes irrevocable. That's a little bit more complicated. I want to get into that, but let's take our break, Rick. And I think
with a cliffhanger.
I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger. Yeah, it's going to take a little bit of explanation. I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger and go right to the IT provisions of our show and talk about a great IT guy named Ken Rubin. Tell us about Ken.
Well, Ken is the owner of High Road Data, and he specializes in IT consulting, does some web design, but I know we both have known Ken for many years now,
mm-hmm.
and he is a very reputable, very credulous IT guy who's been involved in many pretty high end situations. Most recently, several years ago, he was involved in behind the scenes at both the RNC and the DNC, doing a lot of the IT work for the news station for the news networks, in setting up their networks.
And that would be in Rick's code, the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention, right? Since everybody's not into politics.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ken has been doing this for a number of years. Just oftentimes he can help you just by a phone call and tying into your computer. And sometimes not even that, just boom, here's what you need to do. Boom, boom, boom. So that saves you money. It saves you time. And you get great, 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 great service from Hiro Data and Ken Rubin. So please call Ken for all your IT needs. And where Rick, can they get a hold of Ken?
Yeah, Ken can be reached at 949-939-8270 or by his email at ken@highroaddata.com. That's Ken Rubin with High Road Data.
Okay. Now, let's talk about the second point I was referencing, which says that you have a right to inspect the trust instrument. Remember, I don't want to confuse people here, so I want to be very particular about this. Remember I said you have a revocable and an irrevocable trust, and upon an irrevocable, if you have an irrevocable trust, if the creator has an irrevocable trust, that beneficiary is entitled to the property at the time the trust is funded, not to mention an inspection of the trust, right? However, in that case, the creator of the trust is still alive. Now let's go back to the revocable trust, when you can change. When are you entitled to inspect the trust, and when are you entitled to know what you're going to get? When do your rights vest, and when are you entitled to that property? When are you entitled to inspect, and when are you entitled to receive the property from a revocable trust? When it becomes irrevocable, when does it become irrevocable? Upon the death of the creator. So where you have a revocable trust that can be changed any time during the life of the creator, also known as the trustor and the settlor, that revocable trust becomes irrevocable at the time of that person's death, and that's the time the beneficiary of the revocable trust is entitled to inspect the trust and is entitled to have his rights vest in the property that he's entitled to receive. Okay?
All right, that makes total sense. That's it goes back to our Perry Mason analogy.
Right. So, well, yeah, it does in a sense. Unlike in Perry Mason, at least you're informed of the trust and that you're a beneficiary of the trust. You can be that happens in a revocable trust situation even before the creator dies.
Now, so, could a beneficiary request to inspect or review it?
Yes, sir, absolutely. There's no reason why that couldn't happen. And, of course, sometimes that's set forth in the terms of the trust. Other times it's not. And if the request is made, the trustee could certainly comply with that if he chose to do so. If the trustee is not also the creator of the trust, he's going to have that as one of his powers to be able to do that. Now, jumping to the third point, which is important, Rick, because this is what most people always ask about. There must be a yearly periodic accounting of trust assets. Okay? So, in other words, you've got some assets in the trust. You've got property. You've got cash. You've got bank accounts. You've got a whole slew of things. You are entitled to a yearly accounting. Okay, unless the trust says that you're entitled to something more than that, because you can put in the terms of the trust what you want to put in there. Remember, a trust is a contract. You know, and this goes, it's worth a brief little recap lesson on the basis of every, you have a business attorney who does asset protection, estate planning to protect your assets and get you out of probate as well. You have an he also deals in employment law issues for the business that's getting employees and growing and growing. And underneath that framework, that foundation for that business lawyer that does all those three things is contract preparation. Because everything requires a contract, whether you're establishing a business entity, a living trust, an employment contract, an employee handbook, whatever it is, you're preparing a contract. And so a trust is a contract, in effect, and can be have things inserted in it that are going to make it, streamline it for the particular creator involved, or the trustor or settlor. So if the trust document expressly states that the trustee is not required to provide an accounting, then that also can be inserted in the trust, right? In other words, you're entitled to an accounting at least once a year, and you must deliver a final accounting after the notice has been given. Once a notice is sent out, the trustee must deliver one final accounting notice after all instructions have been carried out in the trust. So the trustor dies, a final accounting is done. Meanwhile, while the accountant is alive, while the trustor is alive, a yearly accounting is done, unless the trust says that no yearly accounting is required.
Okay,
then you only have to do one upon the death of the trustor.
All right. So help the viewers understand. So if it's outlined that a yearly accounting needs to be done, who does that?
That would be done either by the law office who created the trust, or by an accounting firm, or even in some circumstances by a paralegal who has the knowledge and the experience to be able to do that. Now that paralegal would most often, of course, work for the law office that created the trust, or you farm it out to an accounting firm to do it, or anyone else that's qualified to be able to do an accounting. There's no set in stone. There's no particular person that has to do it, as long as they have the knowledge to be able to comply with the California Probate Code and the requirements. Okay, and we're going to talk about what needs to be in an accounting. Okay, because you as a beneficiary, when you get this accounting, either at the end when the testator dies or the trustor dies, or during your periodic yearly accountings. Well, you're going to want to know what to expect to see in them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So before we get to that, let me just mention one other brief thing, and that is a beneficiary may waive their right to a yearly accounting. So yearly accounting. Beneficiary can waive right to yearly accounting. The trust may say, hey, you get no yearly accounting. And then at the time of death of the trustor or the creator of the trust, a final accounting must be done by the trustee to the beneficiaries.
Why would a beneficiary waive his right to that?
Gee, why did I see that coming? I assumed that question was going to come, Rick. Well, think of some examples about why a beneficiary would waive a right to an accounting. Maybe the only beneficiary is also the trustee, right? And that person knows what's in the trust because they're handling the trust. And so maybe there's no need to have an accounting by that particular individual. Maybe the estate is so small that it only contains one or two properties, and the beneficiaries are close family members and say, we don't need an accounting for that. We know what's going on. So there are a couple of reasons, and you can expand on that as well, but there are a couple of certain situations where a beneficiary may choose to do that. I'll tell you right now, I wouldn't choose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You could have the estate could consist of 10 M&Ms, and I'd want to know, what's in there.
Okay? Yeah.
Because I like to know what's going on, and I like there to be no room for error.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's talk a little bit, Rick. I know this isn't the most spicy subject in the world, so I don't want to get too technical, but I do want to make people aware of what their rights are and when their rights vest, because these are questions that you often get. Let's talk about this critical accounting we spoke of. Number one, the accounting must show the expenses incurred by the trust. What is the trust expending to keep the trust going? Does it have any costs? Does it have any liabilities? Is it running a business? Is it managing property? Okay, so expenses must be incurred by the trust. If they're incurred by the trust, must be listed in the accounting. Any property that's being distributed to the trustee must be listed in the accounting. Because oftentimes there may be a provision that allows the trustee to purchase property. And if that's the case, any distributions must be accounted for in the accounting. Number three, the extent of the property still held in the trust, okay? Each year, has the property increased? Has the property been depleted? Has some been sold? Has some been purchased? Remember that one of the duties of a trustee, Rick, is to make the trust profitable. So in order to do that, the trustee many times has the power to sell and buy property to up the value of the trust, if that trustee feels that he or she is capable of doing that. The next thing, does the trustee receive compensation? We spoke about that briefly earlier. That needs to be in the accounting. And does the trust have a trust provider or a trust protector, which we also briefly spoke about? And if so, is that person receiving compensation? If so, that needs to be accounted for in the accounting. The accounting must provide the beneficiary the names of all of those persons as well. Okay, any trust provider and any trustee. Each accounting must include language informing the beneficiaries that they have the right to ask the court for a review of the accountings. Okay. And then finally, the accounting must inform the beneficiaries that they only have 3 years to sue the trustee if they think the trustee is acting improperly. Okay? That means that from the time that they think that the trustee is acting improperly, they have 3 years to sue. At the time that they are reasonably aware of that. Now, it used to be where you could only sue a trustee for the actions of the trustee at the time of the settlor's death. There's been some interesting case law that we're going to address at the tail end of the show that I want to make people aware of that might affect their rights as a beneficiary very critically. So we'll talk about that in a second. Before I get to that, I want to mention, Rick, that a beneficiary has 120 days after receiving notice of from the trustee about the trust, about the status of the trust, they have 120 days to bring a lawsuit challenging any part of the trust that they think is somehow deficient. Okay, but they have 60 days from the day that a copy of the notice is mailed to them. So, trustee sends an accounting. Okay, let's say the final accounting to the beneficiaries. They have 60 days in which to make a challenge concerning an aspect of the trust. They have 120 days after receiving notice from the trustee about the trust, unless it's personally delivered. And I think I may have convoluted that a little bit. So you have 60 days when the trustee mails or personally delivers a copy of the notice to you. If it's mailed to you, you have 120 days. So you have time to challenge the trust. Okay? Remember, you're challenging the trust, the validity of the trust, how it was constructed, what the accounting situation is. But if you're challenging the trustee for wrongdoing, in other words, you're not saying the trust is deficient, but rather the actions of the trustee are wrong, then you have 3 years to sue the trustee upon learning of whatever you believe the trustee is doing improperly. Does that clear it up a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. I have another question. What if the beneficiary isn't an individual but is an entity? Like I am the, you know, I want to create a trust, but I want the beneficiary to be, you know, I'm a philanthropist. and I want to trust all my assets to, you know, an organization or something like that. Would the same type of things apply, or what would be different?
No, you would sue that entity if you believe that the entity is going to have a custodian, okay, who's going to be running the entity is going to be the trustee running the trust, but obviously they're going to appoint a particular individual within their business structure to does this on a regular basis. They would have a trustee designate appointed in their business that would be handling these sort of things, similar to a custodian of records, maybe, if you will, if that helps analogize it a little bit. So you would you'd want to name, if it was me, I'd want to name that individual and, of course, the company as well, if I was going to sue them for what I believe to be, you know, believed to be wrongdoing. Now, remember, suing a trustee is a trust contest in the sense that you're alleging wrongdoing by the trustee. But also, you can sue believing that the trust is deficient in some way and that the intentions of the creator of the trust are not being carried out. In that particular case, you may or may not involve wrongdoing on the part of the trustee, or it may simply be a capacity issue where you believe that the creator of the trust didn't have full capacity at the time he or she created it, and that therefore their intentions were not supposed to be the way the trust said they were. Okay, so there's a fine line there between challenging the trust for defects and challenging a trustee for wrongdoing. Okay. Now, in closing, I want to bring to the attention of our viewers and listeners some recent case law. I'm not going to mention the case. I have it here, but I'll mention the first name. It's called Giraldin, and it's Giraldin. And the Giraldin case basically says it changes the law somewhat. Normally, you can't sue a trustee for wrongdoing, right? Unless the creator of the trust has passed away and you believe you've been wronged as a beneficiary. Well, in Giraldin, the court said that the beneficiaries had standing after the death of the creator of the trust to put themselves in the place of the creator of the trust and sue the trustee as if the creator of the trust was still alive. In other words, a survival action. So here's what we got. Picture it this way, Rick. You're a beneficiary of a trust. You're suing the trustee for wrongdoing, right?
Mm-hmm.
The wrongdoing you're claiming the trustee committed was against who? You, right? As the beneficiary.
Right.
Now, in Giraldin, you're saying, wait a minute, I'm going to sue the trustee again after the creator of the trust dies, but I'm going to step into the shoes of the creator of the trust and say that the wrongdoings that you committed, Mr. or Mrs. Trustee, was against the creator of the trust, which of course affects me. Hmm. So now you're stepping into the shoes of the creator of the trust and you're suing as if that creator was still alive. So how does that make it different? Well, let's say you're a trustee of a trust between 2005 and 2010. The creator of the trust dies in 2005, right? Well, what about all the damages that occurred between 2000 and 2005? Okay? Trust is created in 2000. The creator of the trust dies in 2005. Now you're saying the creator of the trustee, rather, is committing wrongdoings from 2005 onward, right? Okay. And you're going to sue that trustee based on the fact that you're a beneficiary. But what about the damages that were caused between 2000 and 2005 when that person was not yet a trustee, right? Because it didn't become a trustee until the death of the creator in 2005. So what about the first 5 years of damages where they took advantage of the individual? Let's give it this example. Mom creates a trust in 2000. Daughter Joey, or Joan, let's say, is a beneficiary. She moves in with Mom in 2000. Mom dies in 2005. Joni becomes the trustee to distribute the trust assets to her two sisters, Joanne and Mary. Joanne and Mary say, wait a minute, you've been committing some wrongs here between 2005 and the time the property is going to be distributed. We don't want the property distributed. You've committed a number of wrongdoings. We're going to sue you. And Joanne says, well, fine, you can sue me from 2005 onward because I wasn't a trustee before that. Now, the other two sisters can say, ah, but we can also sue you for what you did from 2000 to 2005 before you were the trustee, because you ripped Mom off, and now we're going to stand in Mom's shoes and sue you for all of those damages before you officially became the trustee in 2005. That's what Haraldson says, in essence.
So what was the outcome of that?
Well, the outcome is that you can collect damages if you can prove your case. The outcome of Haraldin specifically isn't really pertinent to what we're discussing here, because that had a specific set of facts that we're not dealing with in our example. But the point it's raising is the same. You're able to step into the shoes of the creator of the trust after the creator is dead, and sue for damages you believe were caused to that trust by another individual. Where before you couldn't do that, right? You could only sue as a beneficiary who's been damaged directly. Now you're suing as the creator by creating a survival action. You're saying this action that the creator of the trust would have ordinarily had she still been alive survives her death and allows the beneficiaries to step in her shoes and sue on her behalf. So that's important. Why? Because, I mean, let's face it, we're talking about beneficiaries' rights, right, Rick? And that seems to me to be a pretty darn critical one.
Yeah, that's a pretty substantial ruling then, if you can protect the trust by being able to step back and do that.
Right. And so there are cases that involve that. There's a case I'm dealing with right now that directly involves that specific issue and will have to be litigated. Now, remember, just a quick note, it's really not on topic for the show, but probate and family law, which, you know, is divorce court typically, family law and probate are courts of equity. They're not courts of law. They're courts of equity. What does that mean to the listeners? That means that only a judge tries cases in courts of equity. You don't have a jury. So you're dealing with facts that you have to present to the judge instead of facts that you have to present to the jury. And in a court of equity, the judge is the trier of facts and the trier of law, whereas in a civil court where there's a jury, the judge is only the trier of law and the jury is the trier of facts. So you want to be, some people might perceive that as an advantage, others may not. You're hoping that the court will, of course, apply the law correctly as it pertains to the particular facts of your circumstance. So anyway, I hope that's been helpful, Rick. I mean, remember your rights vest in a will and irrevocable trust upon the death of the creator. Your rights vest in an irrevocable trust. I'm sorry, did I say that right? Will and irrevocable trust, rights vest upon the death of the creator. Irrevocable trust, your rights vest upon the funding of the trust. Remember that a revocable trust becomes irrevocable upon the death of the creator. And then, of course, you have certain rights, among them being a right to an accounting. And we've spoken in detail, I think, about the items that need to be contained in an accounting. So feel free to go back and listen to this show again. Jot down what your five or six critical rights are and know what they are, because after all, it affects you. And we know that the creator of that instrument wouldn't have put you in there as a beneficiary if it wasn't going to affect you in some way, shape, or form.
That's right. Well, this is a very fascinating topic and can be a very complex one depending upon your situation. And so that's why a guy like Bill, it's of utmost importance if you are in a situation where you are looking to create a trust like this to contact somebody like Bill, because you can't find a one solution that fits all online that will address your specific needs.
No, this is a good example of that, Rick. That's a good point. And let's just really end the show on one last important issue. Remember, this is where trust law and asset protection can overlap and why attorneys need to be aware of both. If you have an irrevocable trust, one that cannot be revoked, you can use it both to avoid probate and to shield assets. One quick example that we talked about in another show as a reminder. Rick and I own a business. We own it 50% each. I create an irrevocable trust. He creates an irrevocable trust. He takes his 50% of the business and he gives 20% of it to his trust. Then he sells the other 30% to his trust. I do the same with my trust. We now hold a note on that business in each of our respective trusts. And as the trust becomes profitable, we can draw interest payments, okay, monthly interest payments or yearly interest payments from the note we hold on the 30% of the business that we each sold to our respective trusts. In addition to that, we can put each other as a beneficiary. So if I die before Rick, Rick gets my 50% of the business coming back his way. Now he owns it again. The trust doesn't own it any longer. And the same if he passes away first. So this is where you can create an asset protection plan using an estate plan. Okay? So I'll leave you with that. There's a lot of interesting ways to go. And again, this is addressed in a prior show, and you can find that on our website, Rick, and people can listen to it at their leisure. And they can find us in all kinds of locations, which you have for them, right?
Yeah, exactly. You'll see the information below this video. If you want to, if you're new to trusts or need more information on that, obviously contact Bill, and we'll get his contact information here shortly. But if you'd like to view the show of Estate Planning 101, that's a great place to go to understand these different types of trusts that Bill referred to today, and that. Is you can find that on bottlebusinesssenseshow.com. The broadcast date was July 22nd, episode 8. So review that one, and if you have more questions, Bill's the guy to talk to, and what's the best way to get a hold of you, Bill, to continue that discussion?
That would be, of course, at the following phone numbers, both 949 area code. The office phone is 698-6222. That's 6222. And the personal phone is, which I always make available to prospective clients and clients, is 413-6535. And, of course, email would be bill@wfblegalconsulting.com. And also, Rick, a quick reminder, there is a more in-depth show on irrevocable trust somewhere in our library as well. So after they listen to 101, they can go and they can get, a lengthier discussion about the particular asset protection trust I just discussed here at the tail end of the show.
Okay.
So until next week, we'll look forward to having another show and another great show planned for you. We're always eager and happy to come on and provide you with important information to help you grow and protect your business. So until then, we'll say see you on the other side. Rick, have a great week, and everyone out there, have a prosperous week as well.
All right, great. You too, Bill. We'll see you guys next week on the Bottle Business Sense Show here at 10 a.m. on Tuesday. Take care.
Take care, everybody.